Exodus 17:1 through 17:16. The 19th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on December 29, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
In the middle of the desert, trudging across the desert, mile after mile. Exodus 17 is what we'll be talking about today. God had freed the Egyptians with a dramatic show of power and was beginning to move on his promise that he had made to the ancestors of the Israelites to give to them and to make them into his own people and to give to them a land flowing with milk and honey. And so the Israelites left Egypt and they enter into the desert, and all they see is mile after mile after mile of barren desert. And they suffer from hunger, they suffer from thirst, and they begin to ask the question. We've seen this over the last few chapters. Yes, we have left slavery, but when we were slaves, we had food. It may not have been wonderful, but we had what we needed. Our basic needs were taken care of. Now we've got freedom, but we're hungry. Was it worth the trade? And their thinking is, it's not. It's not worth the trade. Something's gone wrong. God began to move and was going to sweep us out of Egypt and take us to something wonderful, and on the way to something wonderful, it's not great. It's worse. On the short run, it's worse. And the only thing that could make it better is the knowledge of that promise that's out there, but can that promise be trusted? What's the promised land like? Is it really flowing with milk and honey? So we've seen incidents in which they have questioned whether this is the right thing, whether this is an improvement, and seriously questioned that. And in chapter 17, we're going to see another time where they question that same thing. It's at the waters of Meribah. And this is an event that is often referred to in the rest of the Old Testament and then in the New Testament as an example of the faithlessness of the Israelites. In the midst of God's leading, they could not trust him. They didn't think that he was taking care of them. And this chapter 17 is one example of that. And the crisis of no water in chapter 17 turns into kind of a political crisis. And there are murmurings of a kind of coup of taking Moses' life. Let's look at chapter 17, starting with verse 1. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin according to the command of the Lord and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, What shall I do to this people? A little more and they will stone me. Then the Lord said to Moses, pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he named the place Massah and Meribah, because the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Okay, the history leading up to this, their journey through the Red Sea, if you will remember back, they passed through the Red Sea, God opened up the waters, they walked through on dry land, the Egyptians who were chasing them also entered in to the passageway through the waters of the Red Sea, and God closed it in upon them and killed them. So the Israelites made it safely to the other side of the Red Sea. And the other side of the Red Sea is the beginning of this voyage through the desert. They hiked 3 days into the wilderness of Shur from the shore of the Red Sea. And it was there, if you will remember, that they had been 3 days without water. And there in the wilderness of Shur, they found water, but it was brackish. And they complained. And Moses called out to God, and God said, take the tree, stick it in the water. And they did so, and the waters became drinkable. Then they hiked a little further to Elim, which was an oasis with, 26 springs and date palms. It's not clear how long they stayed there. Then they hiked further, and 6 weeks into their trip, they were in the wilderness of Sin, and there they were without food. They complained to Moses. Moses called out to God, and God sent manna, bread from heaven, and quail to eat. Then, it says at the beginning of this passage, they journeyed, 3 stages? Apparently that, it says, journeyed by stages. Apparently that means stops. They made a few stops along the way. And we can tell from Numbers 33 that there were apparently 3 stops. And then they make it to Rephidim, where this particular thing occurs. Here, there's no water. Here at Rephidim, there's no water. Not even brackish water. So they complain to Moses. It's not a complaint to God. They don't address their complaint to God. They complain to Moses, and they say to him, give us water that we may drink. So they look to the human leadership here, and they're saying, give us water. We need water. Give it to us. And Moses' response here is, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? So Moses is seeing this as a challenge of God's leadership that is being pointed at him. But he sees that it's actually a challenge to God's leadership. They're questioning whether God is in control of things or not, whether God is here and present, active, and taking care of things. And they think that he's not. Now, it says that they quarreled. What would this quarrel consist of? And I think that basically what the people are saying is things are worse here than it was in Egypt. In Egypt, we had food and drink. They say, why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? Things have gotten worse and not better. In Egypt, we had food and drink. We weren't going to die of thirst and hunger. Here, there's a threat of that. This is a worse situation than we had before. And if it's worse, there must be something wrong. Things must be out of God's control. He's not here. God's not taking care of us here. And the reason I think it could be that they're questioning his goodness. It could be that they're questioning his power. that he isn't capable of taking care of things, or they're questioning his absence. He's just not present with them. He's just not there taking care of their concerns. He's delayed elsewhere. And I think because of what it says later, that it's that latter option. If you look at verse 7 again, the place was called Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" So presumably they're not questioning his goodness nor his power, but rather his presence. He's not really involved in their daily lives. He's off taking care of matters elsewhere, is distracted, and does not realize the kind of suffering that we are suffering here, that we're undergoing. So as they're picturing it then, God has gone, he's left Moses in charge, and Moses is not doing a good job. Moses has got him into a mess. Moses' perspective is, God led us here. Things may not be great. We may not have all the water we need, but things are not out of control. God is not elsewhere. God is leading us. And Moses, I think, would be saying to himself, I know. He's been telling me what would be happening. Things have been happening according to schedule. He's the one who led us here. We do, after all, have the cloud and the pillar that are leading us. Things are not out of control. So we may be suffering, but that doesn't mean that things have gone haywire. A comment here, just a side comment, but one that I find revealing and one that's very characteristic of me. When they complain, they say, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" If you'll recall, they left Egypt with livestock. And they've still got livestock when they reach Rephidim. That means that when they were complaining about having no food at the last stop, they still had their livestock. So it is not the case that they have been absolutely exhausted of all resources, but rather, comparatively speaking, they were hungry and they were out of food, rather than being absolutely hungry and out of food. And that is so typical of my life. As I look at my times that are times of trouble, times that are absolutely unbearable, in the midst of them, they really do seem absolutely unbearable. But when I get a little perspective on it, either hear about sufferings that other people have had, which are much more severe than what I'm going through, or even after I've gotten away from a little bit and I see how things weren't quite as bad as they seemed, it helps to put things in perspective. But in the midst of it, it's very difficult to see that that's the case. In the midst of it, it really seems like the world is coming to an end, no matter how trivial the problem is. Okay, this is the first time that the people have become really, really angry with Moses. He thinks that they are on the verge of stoning him. Now, they got mad at him on the shore of the Red Sea. They have been angry with him before. But at this point, they're on the verge of stoning him. And we'll see that when we get later on, Aaron has the same concern that they might take his life, might actually take his life. So apparently it was a real danger. But if you think about it, what a strange response to their problem. Their problem is a lack of water. How will stoning Moses do anything to help them with this particular problem? If they kill Moses, they're killing their leadership. And then it's kind of every man for himself. Unless they can reestablish leadership, which historically is difficult for groups to do, unless they can quickly reestablish leadership, then it's every man for himself. It's not going to be an improvement of the situation. In fact, as we'll see in the next section, it probably would have been their destruction, because the Amalekites were on their heels, killing off any stragglers. Any group of Israelites that were behind, the Amalekites would come along and wipe them out. So had the Israelites killed their leadership at this point, the chances are the Amalekites would have destroyed them, would have been able to defeat them quite easily. So this is not a rational response to their problem, but rather it's an emotional response to their problem. They see the problem as Moses, rather than their own lack of trust in God. Now Moses' response here, I'm not sure how to interpret this, what significance to place on this. His response is, "What shall I do to this people?" At least that's the English translation. That seems like kind of a strange response on Moses' part, because it seems like what he should say is something along the lines of this: God, what would you have me to do with respect to these people? Moses has been an agent of God all the way along, and I think has clearly seen himself as such. But on this occasion, he says, "What shall I do to this people?" And the language makes it seem as though he's taken it upon himself, that he is not one of them. He is separate from them, and in a position to be in a place of fathering them, of applying the discipline. He himself, rather than just as an agent. Now, I don't know whether that should be read into this or not. I think this is difficult. It becomes trickier when we read further on. I stared at this for some time, and finally concluded that there are two incidents during this trip through the wilderness in which God brings water forth from the rocks. There is this one at Rephidim, and there is apparently another one near Kadesh. Look at Numbers chapter 20. I'll read this section. It's going to sound extremely similar. There are a few minor differences, but I think this is actually a different incident. Numbers chapter 20. "Then the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness of Zin," with a Z instead of an S, "in the first month, and the people stayed at Kadesh. Now Miriam died there and was buried there. And there was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves against Moses and Aaron. The people thus contended with Moses and spoke, saying, 'If only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. Why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? And why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us into this wretched place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there water to drink.' Then Moses and Aaron came in from the presence of the assembly to the doorway of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to them. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Take the rod, and you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes, that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock, and let the congregation and their beasts drink.' So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock. And he said to them, 'Listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?' Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank. So this, there are a lot of similarities here, but there are a few differences. It was a different place. It was at a different time. And it says after, let's see, if only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. And that was an incident referred to earlier in Numbers. So the setting is different, and yet much of the circumstances in the event is very similar. But on this occasion, what they did was offensive to God. Verse 12, but the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. So on this occasion, the way that Moses and Aaron carried out God's instructions was not correct. They did not do it as God had asked them to do it. Now, exactly what they did wrong is not, I'm not sure yet. Some people say it's that he struck the rock twice instead of once. Some say that it was that he struck it at all. Some is that they point to his arrogance. In 10, it says, listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? I'm not sure. But looking back, though, at the event in Exodus 17, it seems to me that it is possible that we see a hint of the same problem in 17, that it could be that Moses is taking responsibility and therefore that he should take the credit for this on himself. But I don't know. I don't know if that should be read into this or not. In any case, what God told Moses to do was to pass in front of the people. Apparently he was to go from the midst of the people out to the lead and go a little bit further to a place that God would show him on the rocks. He was to take the staff. It was the same staff that he had as a shepherd in the desert that God had him lay down on the ground, and it changed into a serpent, and he was to grab it, and it turned back into the staff. It's the same staff that he carried into Egypt, the staff that he struck the waters of the Nile with, and they turned to blood. This is the staff that has been the instrument of God's working all the way through these plagues, and has become kind of a symbol of Moses' authority under God. So he is to walk out before the people with his staff, go to the place that God shows him, with some of the elders. So with some of the recognized authority of the group, go forward, and he strikes the rock, just as earlier he had struck the Nile. And at that time, it had made the waters undrinkable. This time, he strikes the rock, and waters come out. And apparently, it's a gusher. There's water for all of the people, as well as the animals, to drink. So, they all see this, at least the elders, it says in the sight of the elders. The elders see this happening. They're all able to drink. But the place is now named Massah, which means testing, and Meribah, which means contention or quarreling. Now, why is this called a place of testing? Quarreling makes sense to me. They were quarreling as to whether they should see this suffering as a sign that things were out of control and they need to do things differently. That seems to be the quarrel that occurred between Moses and the people. But why testing? And in fact, it's not testing of the people. It says in verse 7, because they tested the Lord. So it's the people testing God. In what sense were the people testing God? Now, I mentioned that there are other places where this event is referred to. One of those is Deuteronomy 6:16, when Moses is giving his final speech to the people of Israel before they enter into the promised land. He gives them the law. And in addition to giving them the law, again, restating the law, he gives them a number of cautions and warnings. And one of those is stated here. He says, "You shall not put the Lord your God to the test as you tested him at Massah." That is the verse that Jesus ends up quoting in, when he is tempted by Satan, when he goes into the wilderness for 40 days, and Satan comes to him and tests him. Turn to Matthew 4. Let me just refresh your memory by reading the first few verses of this chapter. "Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he then became hungry. And the tempter came and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread.' But he answered and said, 'It is written, man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God.' Then the devil took him into the holy city, and he stood him on the pinnacle of the temple, and he said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will give his angels charge concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone.' Jesus said to him, 'On the other hand, it is written, you shall not tempt the Lord your God.' And again the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, 'All these things will I give to you if you fall down and worship me.' Then Jesus said to him, 'Begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only.' Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and began to minister to him." So in the second temptation, in this exchange of scriptures, Satan is saying, throw yourself down from this temple and let God save you. Let God bear you up, protect your life. And he quotes one of the Psalms as evidence that that would be a good thing for Jesus to do. But Jesus comes back with this verse from Deuteronomy saying, "You shall not tempt the Lord your God." And apparently what he's saying here is, you ought not put God in the situation where you are forcing him to come to your rescue. You ought not tempt God in the sense of, test God in the sense of seeing whether he, questioning whether he, whether he's got things under control. And that's the best sense I can make of it here, that here in Rephidim, the question is, does God have things under control? And the people are saying, we don't think so. And in that sense, they're testing God. I think this is this incident is very significant in my thinking about my own life. Because there's a sense in which any Christian is going through their exodus. But the exodus, as I see it, is God introducing, showing himself, revealing himself to this, his people, making himself known for who he is, what kind of being he is, and what he requires. And at the same time, making it clear to them what kind of people they are, and how they need to change, what needs to happen in their lives. And so we're kind of going through the same process of learning who God is and learning who we are. And as a result, we're all kind of in a desert-like situation in which we run out of water, we run out of food. And there are times when we question whether it wasn't better back before God came into our life. And I can remember one time, a long time ago, someone asked me, who suffers more, Christians or non-Christians? And I can't remember how I answered then, but I was thinking about that as I was looking through this passage. In the case of the Israelites, there's really no question. They're suffering more after they left Egypt than before. If what we're thinking is in terms of comfort, if we're thinking in terms of being fed and having water, they were better off in Egypt. The difference, though, is they were slaves in Egypt. And here in the desert, they're free. So now, which is better? Well, it's only better in the desert if you acquire a taste for freedom. And one of the things that God is doing is readjusting our value system so that we have a taste for freedom. Being free, and in our case, it's freedom from sin. It's freedom from the tyranny of sin over our lives. And God is developing in us a taste for righteousness, for freedom. It's strange that that should have to be a developed taste, but it is. And as he develops that taste, then we see that these sufferings then become trivial as compared to what we have gained. It's only as we use the value system of a non-Christian looking at our lives that it looks like the bargain is a bad one. But as we learn to appreciate righteousness and what God is doing in our lives, then the sufferings that we go through now, the lack of food and water, are trivial. So are the sufferings greater as a non-Christian? In one sense, absolutely yes. But in another sense, there's no comparison. This is a better deal. Let me quickly go through the next half of the chapter. I mentioned before that the Amalekites were on the heels of the Israelites. And there in the second half of the chapter, the Israelites fight against the Amalekites. Starting in verse 8, then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. And so Moses said to Joshua, choose men for us and go out, fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. And Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed. And when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. It doesn't say here what the significance of this defeat of the Amalekites is in Exodus. But it talks about this in Deuteronomy 25:17 through 19. This is when, again, Moses is recounting what their history with God since the time of the Exodus. And he says, remember what Amalek did to you along the way when you came out from Egypt. How he met you along the way and attacked among all the stragglers at your rear when you were faint and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore it shall come about when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your surrounding enemies in the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance to possess. You shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You must not forget. Now the events that had surrounded their departure from Egypt had been spread throughout the ancient Near East. So when the Israelites went into
the Promised Land, the peoples that were living there had already heard what God had done to bring them out of Egypt and were scared. But here we have one people that was not awed by what God had done. The Amalekites, they come and begin to attack the Israelites. But rather than a direct attack, they are kind of hanging around the periphery of the Israelites. And any stragglers, any who are weak, they're coming along and killing them. So it's kind of a battle of attrition, that they're going to just eat away at them, kind of like my kids like to watch animal shows. And there are a number of animals that like to... They're animals that herd together for protection. And I guess coyotes and hyenas do this. They try to get someone off, away from the rest of the herd, and then pick on that. So the Amalekites are kind of like those coyotes or hyenas trying to get pick off the ones that are strays. Which is a particularly, when you think of it, it's a particularly disgusting way of taking on the Israelites. That is picking on those who are suffering the most, those who are in some way broken off. They hope to defeat the Israelites by that strategy. And so God is particularly angry with respect to the Amalekites. And in this battle, the Israelites prevail. They defeat the Amalekites. And then afterwards, verse 14 through 16, then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and named it, the Lord is my banner, or my standard, my flag. And he said, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. And historically that did happen until the time of Saul, when they were finally completely defeated. The Amalekites were destroyed completely and ceased to exist as a people. So in that way, God demonstrated his concern for those who were straggling behind, those who were suffering. And he sought vengeance for the damage that had been done to them by the Amalekites. I know I've mentioned this before, but the thing that this Exodus brings home to me is this combination of God's activity in our lives that, as we pan back from it, it seems quite evident that God has entered in here and here and here in very dramatic ways. I certainly see that in my life. And I expect that most of you see that in your own lives, that as you pan back, you can see God's activity. But as we pan back in, focus in on the day-to-day, it's just day-to-day drudgery. God isn't there. He's not there in my life any more than he's in the life of some non-Christian. It's just changing diapers. It's washing clothes. It's going to work again with a headache. And I mean, it's just the things that we all experience, and it doesn't seem like God's there at all. How could he be? It's so mundane. And yet, I think what we see here is, even in that, God's there and working. He's not just working in the dramatic events, but he's right there, a part of the very mundane, the suffering, the boredom, the anguish, whatever it is, he's right there in it, and using that, working in our lives to help us to come to adopt the values that he has, to come to value what he values. And for the most part, that's not food and water. but rather that's righteousness. It's reflecting and living out His character. And the mundane helps to build that into our lives. It's a strange way for God to go about doing things, but I'm convinced it's effective. He does accomplish what He seeks to accomplish. Questions and comments? Yes?
With the presence of God already being represented with the smoke and fire all this time?
Yes. That's one of the things that's curious about this account, is because there are a number of things that the Israelites could look at on a day-to-day basis and see it as God caring for them. They have started to receive the manna, and presumably they continued to receive it even when they were at Rephidim. The cloud was falling, it was leading them during the daytime and the pillar of fire at night. And presumably it was still there even at Rephidim. But the problem is, and I know from my experience, that there's this temptation to see, if it's there day after day after day, it's just part of the backdrop. It's not God. It's just the scenery. My paycheck. One can see that two different ways. One can see it as just something that's there. I mean, it's just kind of like the rain. It's like, it's things that are just there. I mean, it's not God, it's just there. But on the other hand, there are times when it becomes very clear it's God. But it's only in times of crisis that it's God. When it's not a time of crisis, then it's just there. And I think that's what happens with the manna. In time of crisis, they see, they come to the realization, yes, that's God's provision for me. But it goes on day after day, and there's no crisis anymore, and it's just there. Yes, Dan.
David, I like the specificity of your last thought in reference to the mundane of our own lives. And you mentioned at the point where the Israelites were threatening Moses and wanting to know if God was really in control, and you cited some examples of how Christ's temptations visited that idea. Rather than, I like to think, that they were threatening in reference to whether or not God was in control, the whole big picture, they were threatening as to whether or not God was right there with them in their own specific paycheck, need for a meal, need for a drink. And I see that as an opportunity for us to threaten God when things are personally, individually difficult, and not to respect the whole big picture that this is a struggle through which we're going. And so even though, well, yeah, God's in control of the whole big picture, but He isn't here right now because, Stan's hurt kind of bad because he doesn't have this. And so I threaten. That's a personal experience. And I just was going to draw into the fact that it's the personal experience that we're threatening, the water, not necessarily that God is in control of the whole thing. They're not really caring about the whole thing.
Right.
Each, you and I, care only about our personal hazard at the moment. And we need to reflect on the fact that God is in control of the whole big picture. And as you also said, then you step back every once in a while, oh yeah, back there He was in control, I just didn't see it. It really is a personal reflection on our day-to-day experience, and this is what's told in the story.
We just, by nature, we have such narrow vision. By nature, we focus in on ourselves and our problems now. That's all that's within our viewing screen. And that's incredible. I mean, it's just, but that's the way we are. We just, it's now, it's my problem, and where is God in this? And it's very difficult for us to pull back and put things into a bigger perspective.
How developed was their faith? It seems like they had an identity as a people, but as a faith, it doesn't seem like they had one at all. It's like God is taking just a bunch of bugs and instilling faith in them. And I wonder...
You mean their faith as far as their religion, their understanding of who God is?
Yeah, it seems to be pretty basic.
Well, yeah, I think what we have in Exodus is the process that God is taking this group of descendants of Abraham and others and making them into, first of all, a people, and also God's people. So they are in the process of two things. One, coming to an understanding of themselves as a people rather than a bunch of just a bunch of outcasts, and recognition of the fact that they are God's people, recognition of God and who He is and His values. And God is taking them through a process by which He is accomplishing that. And we're only partway through that process. He has yet to give them the law, for instance. So they're just in the beginning stages of learning who God is and what God requires of us. Yes?
I think this is just an excellent point you're making about how a lot of times when you're in trials that we think that God is not there, that God is not with us when He is. But then there's other times, like when they went and attacked Ai, that God wasn't with them. They experienced trials not because He was with them, they just weren't trusting, but He really had removed His presence or His work in them at that point. And so how do we tell the difference between when we're experiencing God's judgment because of our sin and times when we just need to trust Him and just keep walking?
Well, when I say He's with them, what I mean is He's involved in every detail of what they experience. In that sense, even at Ai, He was with them. He was working through the circumstances, teaching them. In that case, He was teaching them the consequences of their disobedience. But still, He was there involved in everything that was going on there. Things were not out of control. But you're right, there are times when our suffering is a consequence of our wrongdoing, and there are other times when it is not a consequence of our wrongdoing. And all I know is to let God sort that out. I mean, at least in my life, He certainly had the ability to bring that home to me one way or another, that as He touches my conscience and makes me sensitive to various things that I have done, and shows me their consequence, I begin to see, I can in time see, that suffering in this instance is a result of wrongdoing on my part. So I think it's only as God shows us, as God makes clear to us, that our suffering is a consequence of our wrongdoing, that we should interpret it as judgment.
I really liked Nancy's comment in the paper that she, the last paper she wrote, about how suffering is a faithful guide, and how merciful God is, and getting our attention through it, you know, and bringing things into focus. And just there's almost no escaping, coming to terms with it, you know, or just bitterly succumbing to it in some sense, you know. But even then, you eventually sort of have to get up and reckon with the truth of it. And it's just. It's an awesome thing.
It is.
It's a gift.
It's strange but true. As Christians, we develop a taste for suffering itself. Not because we're masochistic, but because we realize that there is so much good that comes out as a consequence of suffering. That it is such a difficult process to wrench us away from the value system of the world and to develop in us a taste for God's values. And suffering's the only thing that can bring that about. But it's such a good thing that even the suffering becomes in a sense, a good thing. We need to quit.